Supreme Court of the United States, John D. Ashcroft versus Javed Iqbal, May 18, 2009, Justice Kennedy delivered the opinion of the court. Respondent Javed Iqbal is a citizen of Pakistan and a Muslim. In the wake of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, he was arrested in the United States on criminal charges and detained by federal officials. Respondent claims he was deprived of various constitutional protections while in federal custody. To redress the alleged deprivations, respondent filed a complaint against numerous federal officials, including John Ashcroft, the former Attorney General of the United States, and Robert Mueller, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI. Ashcroft and Mueller are the petitioners in the case now before us. As to these two petitioners, the complaint alleges that they adopted an unconstitutional policy that subjected respondent to harsh conditions of confinement on account of his race, religion, or national origin. In the district court, petitioners raised the defense of qualified immunity and moved to dismiss the suit, contending the complaint was not sufficient to state a claim against them. The district court denied the motion to dismiss, concluding the complaint was sufficient to state a claim despite petitioners' official status at the times in question. Petitioners brought an interlocutory appeal in the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. The court, without discussion, assumed it had jurisdiction over the order denying the motion to dismiss, and it affirmed the district court's decision. Respondent's account of his prison ordeal could, if proved, demonstrate unconstitutional misconduct by some governmental actors, but the allegations and pleadings with respect to these actors are not before us here. This case instead turns on a narrower question. Did respondent, as the plaintiff in the district court, plead factual matter that, if taken as true, states a claim that petitioners deprived him of his clearly established constitutional rights? We hold respondent's pleadings are insufficient. Part 1. Following the 2001 attacks, the FBI and other entities within the Department of Justice began an investigation of vast reach to identify the assailants and to prevent them from attacking anew. The FBI dedicated more than 4,000 special agents and 3,000 support personnel to the endeavor. By September 18th, the FBI had received more than 96,000 tips or potential leads from the public. In the ensuing months, the FBI questioned more than 1,000 people with suspected links to the attacks in particular or to terrorism in general. Of those individuals, some 762 were held on immigration charges, and a 184-member subset of that group was deemed to be of high interest to the investigation. The high-interest detainees were held under restrictive conditions designed to prevent them from communicating with the general prison population or the outside world. Respondent was one of the detainees. According to his complaint, in November 2001, agents of the FBI and Immigration and Naturalization Service arrested him on charges of fraud in relation to identification documents and conspiracy to defraud the United States. Pending trial for those crimes, respondent was housed at the Metropolitan Detention Center, MDC, in Brooklyn, New York. Respondent was designated a person of high interest to the September 11th investigation, and in January 2002 was placed in a section of the MDC known as the Administrative Maximum Special Housing Unit, ADMAXSHU, or ADMAX SHU. As the facility's name indicates, the ADMAX SHU incorporates the maximum security conditions allowable under Federal Bureau of Prison regulations. ADMAX SHU detainees were kept in lockdown 23 hours a day, spending the remaining hour outside their cells in handcuffs and leg irons, accompanied by a four-officer escort. Respondent pleaded guilty to the criminal charges, served a term of imprisonment, and was removed to his native Pakistan. He then filed a Bivens action in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York against 34 current and former federal officials and 19 John Doe federal corrections officers. The defendants ranged from the correctional officers who had day-to-day contact with respondent during the term of his confinement to the wardens of the MDC facility, all the way to petitioners, officials who were at the highest level of the federal law enforcement hierarchy. The 21 cause of action complaint does not challenge respondent's arrest or his confinement in the NDC's general prison population. Rather, it concentrates on his treatment while confined to the ADMAX SHU. The complaint sets forth various claims against defendants who are not before us. For instance, the complaint alleges that respondent's jailers kicked him in the stomach, punched him in the face, and dragged him across his cell without justification, subjected him to serial strip and body cavity searches when he posed no safety risk to himself or others, and refused to let him and other Muslims pray because there would be, quote, no prayers for terrorists, unquote. The allegations against petitioners are the only ones relevant here. The complaint contends that petitioners designated respondent a person of high interest on account of his race, religion, or national origin in contravention of the First and Fifth Amendments to the Constitution. The complaint alleges that the FBI, under the direction of Defendant Miller, arrested and detained thousands of Arab Muslim men as part of its investigation of the events of September 11th. It further alleges that the policy of holding post-September 11th detainees in highly restrictive conditions of confinement until they were cleared by the FBI was approved by Defendants Ashcroft and Mueller in discussions in the weeks after September 11th, 2001. Lastly, the complaint posits that petitioners each knew of, condoned, and willfully and maliciously agreed to subject respondent to harsh conditions of confinement as a matter of policy, solely on account of his religion, race, and or national origin, and for no legitimate penological interest. The pleading names Ashcroft as the principal architect of the policy and identifies Miller as instrumental in its adoption, promulgation, and implementation. Petitioners moved to dismiss the complaint for failure to state sufficient allegations to show their own involvement in clearly established unconstitutional conduct. The district court denied their motion. Accepting all of the allegations in respondent's complaint as true, the court held that it cannot be said that there is no set of facts on which respondent would be entitled to relief against petitioners. Invoking the collateral order doctrine, petitioners filed an interlocutory appeal in the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. While that appeal was pending, this court decided Bell Atlantic Corporation versus Twombly, 2007, which discussed the standard for evaluating whether a complaint is sufficient to survive a motion to dismiss. The Court of Appeals considered Twombly's applicability to this case, acknowledging that Twombly retired the Conley no set of facts test relied upon by the district court. The Court of Appeals opinion discussed at length how to apply this court's standard for assessing the adequacy of pleadings. It concluded that Twombly called for a flexible plausibility standard, which obliges a pleader to amplify a claim with some factual allegations in those contexts where such amplification is needed to render the claim plausible. The court found that petitioner's appeal did not present one of those contexts requiring amplification. As a consequence, it held respondents' pleading adequate to allege petitioner's personal involvement in discriminatory decisions which, if true, violated clearly established constitutional law. Judge Cabranes concurred. He agreed that the majority's discussion of the relevant pleading standards reflected the uneasy compromise between a qualified immunity privilege rooted in the need to preserve the effectiveness of government as contemplated by our constitutional structure, and the pleading requirements of Rule 8A of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Judge Cabranes nevertheless expressed concern at the prospect of subjecting high-ranking government officials entitled to assert the defense of qualified immunity and charged with responding to a national and international security emergency unprecedented in the history of the American Republic to the burdens of discovery on the basis of a complaint as nonspecific as respondents. Reluctant to vindicate that concern as a member of the Court of Appeals, Judge Cabranes urged this court to address the appropriate pleading standard at the earliest opportunity. We granted certiorari and now reverse. Part 2. We first address whether the Court of Appeals had subject matter jurisdiction to affirm the district court's order denying petitioner's motion to dismiss. Respondent disputed subject matter jurisdiction in the Court of Appeal, but the court hardly discussed the issue. We are not free to pretermit that question. Subject matter jurisdiction cannot be forfeited or waived and should be considered when fairly in doubt. According to respondent, the district court's order denying petitioner's motion to dismiss is not appealable under the collateral order doctrine. We disagree. Section A. With exceptions inapplicable here, Congress has vested the courts of appeals with jurisdiction of appeals from all final decisions of the district courts of the United States. Though the statute's finality requirement ensures that interlocutory appeals, appeals before the end of district court proceedings, are the exception, not the rule, it does not prevent review of all prejudgment orders. Under the collateral order doctrine, a limited set of district court orders are reviewable, though short of final judgment. The orders within this narrow category are immediately appealable because they finally determine claims of right separable from and collateral to rights asserted in the action, too important to be denied review, and too independent of the cause itself to require that appellate consideration be deferred until the whole case is adjudicated. A district court decision denying a government officer's claim of qualified immunity can fall within the narrow class of appealable orders despite the absence of a final judgment. This is so because qualified immunity, which shields government officials from liability for civil damages insofar as their conduct does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights, is both a defense to liability and a limited entitlement not to stand trial or face other burdens of litigation. Provided it turns on an issue of law, a district court order denying qualified immunity conclusively determines that the defendant must bear the burdens of discovery, is conceptually distinct from the merits of the plaintiff's claim, and would prove effectively unreviewable on an appeal from the final judgment. As a general matter, the collateral order doctrine may have expanded beyond the limits dictated by its internal logic and the strict application of the criteria set out in Cohen, but the applicability of the doctrine in the context of qualified immunity claims is well established, and this court has been careful to say that a district court's order rejecting qualified immunity at the motion to dismiss stage of a proceeding is a final decision within the meaning of Section 1291.